Good afternoon, and welcome to today's Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley and Markle Center for Applied Ethics program. My name is Judy Nadler. It is my pleasure to introduce former U.S. Congressman Mickey Edwards. Mickey Edwards is Vice President of the Aspen Institute and serves as Director of the Aspen Institute's Rodel Fellowships in Public Leadership. Mr. Edwards was a Republican member of Congress for 16 years, serving as a member of the House Republican leadership and as a member of the Appropriations and Budget Committees. After leaving Congress, he taught for 11 years at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government and for 5 years as a lecturer at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. He's been a regular political commentator on National Public Radio's All Things Considered and a weekly political columnist for the Chicago Tribune and the Los Angeles Times, as well as other major newspapers. His articles have appeared in magazines ranging from The Atlantic to The Public Interest. Mr. Edwards has recently published a book, The Parties Versus the People, How to Turn Republicans and Democrats into America. Please join me in welcoming Mickey Edwards.
Thanks, Judy. This on? I'm on. Well, first of all, I am really so glad to be back here at Santa Clara. I was part of a program at the Markle Center several years ago, so this is like my fifth or sixth time on this campus, and why I would ever leave to go anywhere else is beyond me. It's just, you know, it's a beautiful campus. It's a great school. I'm delighted to be here with my friend Judy, who has been a good friend for so long, and with Ryan Coonerty, the former mayor of Santa Cruz, and a very good friend of mine who's got his class here. And a couple of years ago, the program I run at the Aspen Institute began creating this seminar series where we found the very best young political leaders in America to bring together in a bipartisan setting. And one of the very first people we picked was Mayor Coonerty. So I'm glad to see you here, Ryan. Well, look, so I've noticed something really unique now in politics, that there are front page stories heralding the big news that a Republican and Democrat sat down together and talked to each other. You know, there's something fundamentally strange about that concept. So let me tell you about my book. It came out from Yale University Press, and they insist that I mention the book at least 5 times in every talk that I give. But so the title of the book, which I wrote, and it's really very boring, is The Parties Versus the People. It says what I think, but it's not terribly exciting. People get interested when they look at the subtitle of the book, which I didn't write. The book grew out of an article in The Atlantic magazine. And the editors there put on the article the headline, How to Turn Republicans and Democrats into Americans. When I heard that, you know, I thought, you know, that's kind of harsh, isn't it? And they said, well, did you read what you wrote? And so, the people in Congress, I worked with many of them. I knew them. I spent 16 years there myself. And they're all good Americans. They're patriotic. They love this country. They want to do what's right for this country. But they don't operate as Americans sitting down together to solve problems. They divide into rival clubs as though it was not the United States Congress, but the NFL. When I went to teach, after I left Congress, and I had a chance to go teach, here's the secret, those of you who teach, that I learned, is that when you're teaching, you're on. You're in the classroom. You're trying to persuade. But when you're not, you're in your office, and you have time to think. You have time to reflect. You have time to figure out what you saw and why it worked the way it worked. And I had that chance. And I began to watch the pattern in Washington, where no matter what the issue was, whether it was the budget, a stimulus plan, a Supreme Court appointment, it didn't matter. Republicans were all on one side and Democrats were all on the other side. And I started thinking about why that was, and I kind of got the answer recently. I was speaking in Washington at a meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. I know nothing about science, nothing, you know. But somebody, I must have been a scientist that day, because somebody in the back of the room, big auditorium, they stood up and said, "Oh, you're a systems engineer." And my point is, why does our system of government not work? Why is it dysfunctional? Why is it so hard to solve problems, to get people to work together? It's because of the system that we created, the system in which we conduct our politics. So let me give you a couple of examples. The Barack Obama gets elected president, and so Joe Biden becomes vice president. And there's an opening in the U.S. Senate in Delaware. And Beau Biden, who is Joe's son, one of the more popular people in Delaware, doesn't run. Why doesn't he run? He doesn't run because he knows he can't win. He can't win because everybody there knew who would be the next senator from Delaware. A guy named Mike Castle. Mike had been governor of the state. He had been their congressman. He's very popular. He was certain to win. Every political pro in the country knew he was going to win. But we have this system, see, where you have to, I mean, not every place is California. We have this system where you have to run in a party primary in order to get your nomination. And so they had a primary in Delaware. Big deal. And Mike didn't win. A lady named Christine O'Donnell beat him. Now, here's the thing about that. Okay, fine. You know, people want to vote for her. I don't care who you would have been for. Christine O'Donnell got 30,000 votes. There are 1 million people in Delaware. So she beat it. Why didn't he just then run to the general and beat her? Well, Delaware is a strange place. They have this law, it's called a sore loser law, that if you run for your party's nomination in a primary or convention and you don't get it, your name's not even allowed to be on the ballot in November. So 30,000 people were able to tell 1 million people in Delaware, "I'm sorry, you cannot choose the person that you want to be your senator." Why does that matter? Look, we elected a president. We've re-elected a president. President is a cool job. It's a real, you get a helicopter. You get to have Easter egg parties. It's nice. But every single major power of the United States government, every power of the government is in Congress. It's not in the White House. The power over taxing, spending, going to war, what treaties are approved, who sits in the cabinet, who sits on federal courts. Every one of those is a congressional power. If you have a system where 30,000 people can tell 1 million people, you cannot choose who's going to be there making those decisions for you. You have undercut the entire premise, of government by the people. So I've already said Delaware is weird, right? So let's go to Utah. Utah is 3 million people. Now, in California, that doesn't mean much, but, you know. So Utah is 3 million people, and they had an election, and Robert Bennett, the senator, longtime senator, was running for renomination again. They had a convention, and he didn't win at the convention. There were 3,500 people at that convention. 2,000 people voted against him. Because of those 2,000 people, those 2,000 people told the 3 million people of Utah, "I'm sorry, he cannot be one of your options to serve in the Senate." Because they have a sore loser law. How many states have this unbelievable, crazy, undemocratic sore loser law? 46. So let me use another example. Most of you, you know, your teachers and all, and people in politics, you know everything. Probably there's more people in this room who know the U.S. Constitution backward and forward than any place else I've ever been. I mean, you could recite the Constitution to be backwards if you had to. But there's one thing some of you would not remember. Some of you, a couple of you. Maybe the most single most important part of the Constitution. Every single representative and senator must be an actual inhabitant of the state from which they're elected. The single sharpest division between our government and the parliamentary governments of Europe that our founders knew about. What does that mean? So I want to run for Congress from Santa Clara. What happens? I'm from here. I know you. I know this community. I know how you think. I know what your economic interests are. And you know me. You know my reputation. I'm one of you. If you don't know me personally, you know people who know me. That's representative government. That's the key to what our form of government is. So let me tell you how it really works about representativeness. Judy pointed out, I'm a Republican. I was the first Republican elected. By the way, everything I say here about Republican and Democrat, just turn it over back where both parties are equally bad. So I was the first Republican elected in my district in Oklahoma City since 1928. My district was 74% Democrat. And I won. I don't know how I won. Nobody on my campaign knew how I won. My mother didn't know how I won, but I won. And so the Democrats, who were so totally dominant of the state, tried to defeat me. They couldn't. They tried again. They couldn't. So what did they do? They redrew the congressional district lines because they had a 9-to-1 advantage in the state legislature. Now, you all should be familiar with Oklahoma because we populated California. So, I mean, You know about, so I don't know how many of you have been there, but Oklahoma is at least big enough that all of New England fits inside of Oklahoma. And I represented an urban area, Oklahoma City, roughly the size of Boston. It's not a tiny place. I'm a total city guy. I'm wearing loafers. I'm wearing penny loafers. I mean, yeah, I am a city dude. And I've been to a farm. I think once, I never knew what I was looking at, but I was on a farm. So the legislature, because they couldn't beat me, they redrew my congressional district. It was one county, the center of Oklahoma, took it all the way up to the Kansas border, halfway across to the Arkansas border, a big upside down L. And with apologies to those of you who are in politics, you know, we politicians are all self-referential. It's, you know, it's all about us. And so when I was teaching at Harvard, I would tell my students, look what they did to me. Look what they did. It wasn't about me, was it? Remember what it says in the Constitution? All of a sudden, I, the city guy, know nothing about farms. I was representing wheat farmers and cattle ranchers and small town merchants, and I was their voice in government. I was supposed to articulate their concerns. I was supposed to represent their interests. They, under our constitutional system, were entitled to have representation from somebody who could argue their case, fight for their interests, and they had me because it served the interests of the political parties to take every Republican they could, put them in my district, and make all the other districts safer for Democrats. Republicans have mastered that also. So what's going on here? How is it that we have turned over to the, I'm a Republican, I belong to a party, I believe in parties, I believe in people being able to gather together with people who share their interests and to articulate their concerns and advocate. But when did we start turning over to two political clubs the ability to keep people off the ballot, the ability to decide who will represent who? How did we turn our government over to clubs whose only interest is gaining power, not solving the problems of the American people? So I'm going to make just a couple more points, and then Yeah, it's going to sound like a real downer, right? Actually, I'm pretty optimistic, partly because of California. Let me tell you what it's like in Congress. How a bill becomes a law. God, I hope you're not teaching that stuff. So I don't know how many of you have been on the House floor, but if I were a normal person, which I clearly am not, I would be standing there and speaking, because that's the lectern. And whenever you have something, there's a lectern. And the speaker always stands at the lectern. There's not a lectern on the House floor. There's two. One over here in front of the Democrats for the Democrats to stand at and speak, and one over here in front of the Republicans for the Republicans to stand at and speak. I'm so full of myself that when I was first elected, I just knew. But the first time I ever gave a speech on the House floor, I could just persuade those guys. And so I went over to this lectern in front of the Democrats to look right at them and make my case. And there was this gasp. And Democrats and Republicans alike came over, and this is a true story, and said, no, you have to stand over here. It's like I was going to get cooties if I touched the wrong lectern that somebody of the other party had touched. If you can't eat on the House floor, you can't smoke on the House floor, you can't read on the House floor, you have to go into the cloakroom. There's not a cloakroom. There's a Republican cloakroom way over here in this corner, and there's a Democrat cloakroom way over here in this corner. It's the same in every committee room, too, so that you don't even sit and have coffee and talk about sports together. We have turned our Congress into rival teams, not Americans working together. It's that way in everything you do. I took the oath of office. I was in the freshman, this tells you how old I am, but I was elected in the first freshman, my freshman class, Al Gore and people, Dick Gephardt and Dan Quayle. And, we're all there together. And we all take the oath of office. And it's kumbaya. And whoa, and that lasted 30 seconds until we started making decisions about who would be speaker, who would be on which committees, how the committee ratios would be divided. I love the Markle Center. I love Santa Clara. If all of you in here decided, although this building is great, that you wanted to have another building on campus, you would get together as a group, all of you. And you would say, okay, where should it be? What do we want to house in it? What equipment do we need? How much money do we need? You do all that. Not one person in this room, not one, would say, okay, all the Republicans sit over there and all the Democrats sit over here, and let's, come up with our rival plans about what building we're going to build. We don't do that in any single thing in our lives, except the way we run our government. And that's why it is dysfunctional, because every member of Congress is looking over his or her shoulder. Because the incentives work. Incentive systems work, right? In everything. What do we incentivize with our closed party primary systems in most of the country? What do we incentivize? We have created a system in which those people who are the most intransigent, the most uncivil, the most ideological, the most partisan win. And the people who say, I'm willing to compromise, I'll talk, I'll work with people on the other side, they lose. We wipe them out. Because that's the system we created, a system that rewards all this dysfunction that we're so upset about. The system works. It's what we created. And you can see what we get because of the system we created. So what I've advocated, and just very quickly, some of the things, I don't want to say too much, you won't buy the book. But one of the things that I don't know how well your open primary system is going to work, but it's one of the answers. It's one of the answers. So in 2006, Washington State did it. You did it in 2010. Went to the polls and said, we've had enough of this. We've had enough of letting the parties control who gets on the ballot. We had enough of, you know, so 40% of Americans today are registered as independent. USA Today had an article that said the American people are fleeing from the political party system. The political party system that grew out of the reform movement, the progressives were right. It shouldn't be a bunch of old white guys smoking cigars deciding who gets on the ballot and all that stuff. But the unintended consequence of the primary system they created is the closed primary that is dominated by the ideologues, and we cannot survive. You know, Lincoln was not wrong when he said that a nation divided against itself cannot stand. We're reaping that now in American politics. So I have proposed a number of things. I'll just very quickly. I'm not going to use examples. You all heard Denny Hastert. You heard Nancy Pelosi. You've heard, you know, we do not have legislative leaders in the United States Congress. We have political leaders, party leaders, who function as party leaders. And the party leaders get to choose who sits on what committees. The committees are the choke point of every piece of legislation. How do you get on a committee? You get on a committee by pledging in advance. Before a hearing, before you've read the bill, you pledge in advance that you're going to be with your team on that issue. That's how we fill committees. Why? There are other ways to put people on committees. They don't have to be chosen by party leaders. Shockingly, the Speaker of the House doesn't even need to be a member of Congress. You don't have to have a system that has our government being run by people whose obligation is to their party. I served on committee. I was on appropriations and budget, and I was in the Republican leadership, and we had our staffs. And, you know, your staff, I don't know, maybe there's Republican facts and Democrat facts, Republican numbers and Democrat numbers, but the staff is partisan. Why? You don't need to have partisan staff. You can have professional staff giving you data from which you can make decisions based on the interests of your constituency and your understanding of what's good for the country. So it's in all these areas, it's about the way we staff, the way we elect our officers, and how we put people on committees. You may want to get into questions about campaign finance. If you do, I'll go there. I've got a chapter on it in my book. I'll do the quick little thing about that is to just say, you know, I'm a lawyer. I have to be really careful about this. I don't know if you can say anything about the Supreme Court, if you're a lawyer, but, you know, I don't know what those guys were smoking, but it wasn't legal. You know, the idea that corporations, and are there any lawyers in here? Okay. You'll know this, Ryan. I'm willing to concede the possibility that the justices on the Supreme Court know something about the Constitution. Possibility. I didn't say fact, but possibility. What do they not know? They don't know corporate law, which makes a clear distinction between corporations and individuals. But that's all right. What I have recommended, this is guaranteed to offend everybody. Something I say here will offend every one of you. I have advocated in my book having no campaign contributions other than from living human beings. No corporations, no labor unions, no political action committees, no political parties, just people. I know it's a radical idea, but, you know, maybe it'll go somewhere. All right, well, I'm going to finish by just saying that I'm optimistic because what you did here in California, what was done in Washington State, the bills have just now been introduced in the Texas legislature in the last week to do the same thing. You know, Arizona is bringing it up. You know, I don't know if that's the answer, but the answer is for the American people to take back everybody, you know, every election, take back your country from the people you just gave it to. So the real answer is to take back the country from the political parties and get democracy back into our democracy. So that's the point of my book. I'm glad to, you know, answer whatever questions you want. But it is the parties against the people, and I think it's time for the people to win instead of the parties.
Thank you, Mickey. That was really exciting, and we do have questions, no surprise, generated from what you have asked. So the first one is, how do we encourage citizenship and an engaged public when so many people distrust government?
Boy, I hate that question. I get it a lot. It's a good question. And it's complicated. I know I'm speaking on a college campus, a very nice, good university campus. But this is self-government. The system that I just described is the system we created and the system we allow to continue. What do we not do as Americans? Our public schools stink. We don't teach civics. We don't teach the humanities. We don't teach critical thinking. Madison and the founders gave us a blessing with this kind of country. They also gave us a burden. It takes a certain kind of citizen to be able to sustain this kind of a democratic self-governing system. You can't not participate. You can't fail to vote in primaries. You can't fail to run for office. You can't fail to show up at town meetings when your representative or your mayor or your senator are there. You can't do that. It's democracy. A lot of things are for spectators. Democracy is not a spectator sport. And we have the system we have that works the way it was because we allow it to continue. And so engagement, learning to question, not just watching, you know, there's a story, Judy, that there's studies that show this again, people in this room are the exception, but so many Americans only hang out with people who think the way they do, watch the same shows, you know, it's either Fox or MSNBC, or they read the same columnists, and they don't engage with people who have other thoughts and think critically and intelligently about those. It's part of it's the system, part of it's us and the culture that we live in. And I hate that. I hate to say that. I always hope that I can get through an entire presentation without having to say to the people it's your fault. But yeah, so.
Okay. In your book, you describe the initiative process as a way to return power to the voters.
Yeah.
But in California, this has led to special interests funding private initiatives. All it really takes is money. So how can initiatives be more democratic?
There will always be, of course, you know, I said what I think about campaign funding campaigns. But one of the things that people in politics know is that volunteers, people trump money every time. What happens is people put in money and other people don't get out and do the work that's necessary to overcome it. But, you know, it's not a perfect solution, but it is democracy by definition. If you put it on the ballot and you get something with the 24 states have initiative petitions and you're able to get something on the ballot and get it voted on and change the rules, and you keep changing the rules until you find one that works. And, you know, there are problems with open primary. Actually, the open primary is a general election with a runoff. But, you know, it's better than what you had before. Is it a perfect solution? It's not perfect. Nothing is a perfect solution except us going out and working at it.
Okay. We have several questions, and I'll consolidate them, that deal with gun control and gun legislation.
Yeah.
And people would like you to comment on how it is that only 2,000 people can elect a senator, but the NRA controls the Senate, says the questioner. How can it be the vast majority of Americans want gun control, but the Senate refuses to do that? And there are a couple of other questions that deal with gun manufacturers supporting lobbyists. So, and gun registration laws. So your thoughts on that?
It's an issue that matters a lot to me. You know, I mentioned that Ryan is in this program that I run for the best young political leaders in the country. And the very first fellow ever in our program 8 years ago was a state legislator in Arizona named Gabby Giffords, and who's a very dear, close, personal friend of mine. I actually met Mark Kelly, her husband, when at our very first seminar, she said, "Can I bring my boyfriend?" When I was a college kid, somebody tried to rob me and shot me 3 times, and I still have bullet fragments. You know, I'm not a champion of guns. So how is it that it happens if 90% of the people want something done? Not getting rid of guns. We have a constitutional right, but getting rational controls in place. Why doesn't it happen? Exactly the reason I said before, Judy, is because if you're in the Senate or you're in the House, who are you worried about? Are you worried about the 90%? No. You're worried about the 2,000 people who are going to be at the convention, or you're worried about the 30,000 out of a million who are going to be, you know, voting in the primary. The people who get elected through these processes are not representative of the population as a whole. What if you were to take that's the same question, and you were to say, how is it that they vote considering that the 2,000 people who determined whether you'd be on the ballot feel? Do you think that they feel that way? You know, no, we've created a system where you are, the members of Congress are appealing to, they're beholden to, they're afraid of the people who actually represent the extremes. And that's why we get the results we get.
Thank you. What was the tipping point when the political system moved from policy development to partisan politics?
Well, first of all, not to fall in love with anything in the past, you know, the ideal days of bipartisanship, there were times. I mean, you know, whether it's Civil Rights Act or water, all other stuff. I mean, there was always a time when the majorities of both parties supported a lot of this stuff. But a friend of mine who I taught with at Princeton later wrote a book about foreign policy, you know, the idea that politics ends at the water's edge, just not true. It's never been true in American politics. But the problem, Judy, ask me the question again.
What was the tipping point?
Yeah.
When we went from developing policy.
That's what I thought, tipping point.
The tipping point.
One point.
Well.
There's not.
No.
I thought I was supposed to come up with a tipping point. No, it's been a series of things. Now, I mean, some of you who read that, I mean, I know I always offend people. I can't help it. Part of the problem is that we elected a doofus named Newt Gingrich to Congress. Part of it was before that, a Speaker of the House. So he's a Republican who turned everything into partisan warfare. But before that, there was Jim Wright, the Democratic Speaker, who, for reasons of his own, he was quite sincere in his beliefs during the Reagan days, was afraid that the policies Reagan advocated would pass and Democrats would vote for them. So he started using closed rules all the time that prohibited people from offering amendments. So that got Republicans angry. I mean, it's been a series of things. It's been for at least 30 years, one thing after another that transformed Congress into nonstop partisan warfare. It wasn't a tipping point. Actually, when you said tipping point, I thought you were going to ask, my tipping point when I decided to, you know, I needed to really look at the system. So I want to tell you quickly my tipping
yes.
point. Like all other members of Congress, I had town meetings in my district in Oklahoma City all the time. And at one of those meetings years ago, somebody asked me why I had not done something. I don't remember now what it was. And I gave a political answer. I said, I tried, I got sponsors, I introduced the bill, I'm a Republican, but the Democrats control Congress, and they wouldn't let us bring it up. So, you know, every time we tried to do something, the Democrats stopped us from doing it. And somebody stood up in the back of the room, probably about this many people, and said, I am so sick and tired of hearing Democrat this, Republican that. Everybody in the room stood up and cheered, and I never did it again. And so part of a tipping point is all of you, you know, when you go show up at the meeting with your member of Congress, you can be the tipping point, you know, so that's
good. You were talking earlier about the separate cloakrooms, and I want to just share that a great suggestion from one of our audience members: bring back the days of LBJ when Democrats and Republicans drank whiskey at night and had genuine friendships. That is the intro. In your book, you talk about rearranging the furniture.
Yeah.
That's a phrase that you use to foster greater civility. How would that really work practically?
Well, first let me say something about the getting together and having drinks. You know, there's several different aspects to that, Judy. One of them is that there was a time when members of Congress, and maybe this is part of what was the tipping point, when Newt got elected, he started telling members that they needed to go back home to their district and spend their time campaigning and raising money for the party instead of in Washington. And so very few members of Congress live in D.C. anymore. Back when I was there, we would hang out together. We would go to kids' little league games, and we would go play golf together. And nobody thought about what party the other one was in. You know, it might vote differently on a lot of things, but you were all members of Congress. It wasn't my club or your club. And now almost nobody is still in Washington. They're all back, gone. They don't know each other. They don't know anything except which party the other person is in. That hurts. Another thing that has been a problem, we've created this system of members of Congress not only raising money for themselves for their own reelection, but the average, not the average, every member of the U.S. House today, Republican and Democrat alike, is required by their party to raise $300,000 a year to contribute to the party to knock off members of the other party. So that, you know, that's kind of the way the system has worked. So when I talk about rearranging the furniture, it's trying to break that down. It's trying to have one cloakroom, having one lectern, having, you know, doing away with Republican staff and Democrat staff. It's really changing the system so that it becomes a Congress of Americans, not you go to a committee room. You know, there's a division down there. There's all the Republicans on this side, all the Democrats on that side. You know, change it where you sit according to seniority, not according to party or whatever other ways you want to do it. You got to rearrange the way the Congress works, because now the first thing you do is divide into whether you're red camp or blue camp. That's what I mean by rearranging the furniture.
Thank you. How optimistic are you about the bipartisan effort currently underway aiming to fix the immigration challenges we are facing?
You know, there is some indication. I said before that it sounds like it's a real downer, and yet I'm optimistic about changes because people are fleeing from the system. And so I look what's happening now, whether it's immigration, people are starting to actually talk together. So I'm one of the founders of a group called No Labels. We started with a pretty small group. We've now got over 600,000 people have signed up as members of No Labels. We said, let's create this program called Problem Solvers, who, you know, don't think of yourself as a Democrat or a Republican, but you're willing to make a pledge that you will actually sit down on a regular basis with people in the other party to look at a problem and try to solve it. So we started with like half a dozen Republicans and Democrats that would do that. Now there are 56 members of Congress, some senators, some House members, evenly divided between Republican and Democrat. They meet together every week, together, to talk about problem solving. I think that they're getting the message. So little by little, you see people saying, this can't go on. I don't know how many of you have ever seen this program. It's broadcast on PBS and NPR on radio, PBS on television, called Intelligence Squared, where there are these debates that go on. I filmed one of them Wednesday night in New York, where David Brooks and I were on one side and Ralph Reed and Laura Ingraham on the other side about the Republican Party and whether or not it needs to become broader and start listening to the people. So there is more and more you're beginning to see. Maybe they're just being pragmatic. Maybe they're not becoming all of a sudden, you know, better or whatever, but they're becoming pragmatic. Whoa, the constituency I'm going to have to answer to is getting broader. You know, more people are getting involved, and I have to listen to them. So I think it's having an effect. You know, it's not going to turn around overnight, but I think it's changing.
Well, you brought this up, Mickey, so pledges. During campaigns, many candidates are asked to sign pledges from groups ranging from labor unions to environmentalists. How does this impact the decision-making process?
If you make a pledge in advance to any group, to do anything, you don't deserve to serve. You know, when I made decisions about how I was going to vote on an issue, I had taken an oath of office to uphold and defend the Constitution. That was my oath. Not to be loyal to the president, not to be loyal to my party, but to do three things. Judy knows this because she and I have talked about this before. You have an obligation to make your decisions based on three things only, in my view. Number one is, what do your constituents want? They may be wrong, because they don't spend all their time thinking about these issues. But you've got to listen to them. You've got to pay attention to your constituents because you represent them. You're their voice. And if you cut them out of the system and you don't listen to them, they have no voice in their own government, which undermines our whole system. So number one, pay attention, serious, thoughtful attention to your constituents. Secondly, I'm a Burkean, you know, I believe in what Edmund Burke taught, that you owe it to your constituents when they put their trust in you and they sent you up there to use your own mind and your own experience and your own judgment to always do what you think is the best thing to do for your country. What's in the best interest of the United States? So you pay attention to your constituents, you go along with them every time you can. But if you think that what they want is not in the best interest of the country, you put the interest of the country first. And the third thing, which so many people on both sides of the aisle forget, is what does the Constitution permit and what does it prohibit? Because that's your oath of office, is to the constitutional system. So I think it's those three things. And if you have signed a pledge beforehand to people on the left or on the right or whatever, You are not doing your duty. Your duty is not to be the tool of some interest or another. I mean, so anyway, yeah.
Okay. Would you have any suggestions for the students in the room who are so eager to someday go to work in Congress?
Well, the first thing I'll say is there is nothing, for those of you who haven't done it, I apologize, but there is absolutely nothing more noble than serving in public office. We are a democracy. This is our government. It's our country. The founders, James Madison is my great hero, and James Madison created a government of constrained powers, limited powers, but he created a government to be, you know, to function in the interests of the people. So the first thing I'd say is get active, work in campaigns, hopefully run for office yourself. You know, this is not something to be done by other people. You need to learn to think critically. That is, whatever anybody says, including everything I just said, question it. What's the source? What's the background? How can you prove it? Test everything. Use your brain. You know, hang out with people who don't think the way you do. Have discussions with people in sincere listening mode to hear where they're coming from instead of formulating your rebuttal while they talk. You know, those are things that you need to learn. And with the apologies to whatever some of you teach, study literature, poetry, music, because the thing about democracy is it requires a certain kind of citizen, not just somebody who is knee-jerk on political issues, but somebody who can think more broadly. The humanities will teach you more about being a citizen than any political science course will. So, you know, that's, except unless Ryan's teaching it, of course, but so, yeah.
Do you think there's any chance for a third party to emerge and be successful?
I don't know if there's a chance for a third party to be successful. We have a couple of people in the U.S. Senate now who are independents, Angus King being the most recent in Maine, and I do think there's a real possibility of independents getting elected. It's going to be hard for third-party people to get elected. I'm content if people get elected as Republican or Democrat, whatever that means, and that has a broader range of descriptives, but who are willing to be independent in their thinking. You know, I'm not a big advocate of more parties. I mean, the two we have are so bad, why would we want more of them? And in addition, I mean, and there's a real practical problem in the multi-party systems, because one party cannot have a majority. What you do is you form coalitions, you know, and so you've got a big group, and then you get this people. They can add two people. They can add three. You need them to govern. And what happens is you end up with the little more extreme groups driving the process, because if they defect, you've lost your governing majority. So I'm not a big advocate of multi-party systems.
Okay. Again, referring to your book.
Oh, good. I forgot. I'm probably four times short right now.
I'm helping you. I'm helping you keep up.
Thank you, Judy.
You assert that state and local governments have, and these are your words, abdicated their responsibilities to oversee the election process. What do you mean by that?
The election process is a governing tool. The idea that any state or any local jurisdiction would allow two private clubs that are out seeking their own advantage to determine who can be on the ballot is an abdication of their responsibility. You know, the idea that, well, I'm always bothered, the taxpayers, thank you all very much for funding and paying for the party conventions. That's very nice of you. As a city official or state official, your obligation should be to oversee the election system in your state and not give the real power over to these private entities that are self-seeking, power-seeking groups. I mean, I cannot conceive that the people in charge of elections in California or other states would, well, California is now seen the light, but I can't believe that in so many states what you do when you have the power to govern elections is you turn who can be on the ballot over to the discretion of these ideological interests. It seems to me a complete abdication of government responsibility.
Okay. This is a question regarding public funding, and with the majority of funding for elections coming from privately owned companies and corporations, now that corporations are people, and in an effort to diffuse the his team, my team dynamic, that would, according to this questioner, assert some possible level of public funding. But the question is, why would anyone in power now who was elected by private funding be interested in changing the rules?
Well, first of all, I should say I'm not in favor of public funding, and I'm not for a couple of reasons. Number one is I want to keep citizens involved. I want citizens to contribute, to choose who they want to see and to be engaged. You know, that just drives people farther out of the process. But, say, you know, I have other reasons. You know, several years ago in Louisiana, my party, the Republican Party, nominated David Duke, former leader in the Ku Klux Klan, to be their nominee for Congress. I'm Jewish. I didn't want him getting my money. You know, so, I mean, I think they have, there's some problems there. But I think that what you have to do is empower the people driving out all these interests, as I said, PACs, parties, everybody else out of the system, and put limits on it. I'd say $1,000, $2,000 limit, all of it transparent, all of it out in the open. And by the way, I will say, this is getting off the topic of that question, but it reminds me of something I wanted to say on another question. It is in terms of campaign contributions that I am in favor of full transparency. In terms of what happens in Congress, I am in favor of partial full transparency. Because one of the things that has made it so difficult now to govern is that it is very hard to sit down and compromise with everybody watching. It used to be that you could get together and say, look, we can work this out. So here's a little quick story about that. There was a determination by the U.S. Navy to move two squadrons of E-6A aircraft, surveillance aircraft, from their bases in Hawaii and Maryland inland. So, I mean, because that's when there was a real Soviet Union and they posed a threat. The AWACS aircraft, which uses the same airframe, was maintained at Tinker Air Force Base in my district. And so I got involved, and I managed to get the two squadrons moved to Tinker Air Force Base in my district. Not a bad move for a politician, and, you know, created all these jobs, and it was good. And we had a conference committee between the House and the Senate. And in the conference committee, a guy I admired greatly, who died recently, and a great shame, Dan Inouye from Hawaii. Dan came to me and he said, "Congratulations, that was a great job. These planes are safer inland. You know, I'm glad you got it, but I just wanted to give you a heads up. I'm going to do everything I can to try to defeat that. You know, take that out of the bill in here." I said, "You know, he just told me how great it was." I said, "Why?" He said, "You see that guy back there? He's a reporter for the Honolulu Advertiser, you know, and I cannot be seen to go along with something that will take these jobs out of Hawaii." You know, too much transparency in the political process makes it impossible for people of goodwill to sit down together and say, okay, I can give a little bit here so that we advance. And I will say, compromise, consensus is not possible in a nation of 300 million. But in a nation of 300 million, consensus may not be possible. Compromise is essential. You have to preserve a system in which people will fight for their principles, get what they can, and ultimately compromise so that our troops get their supplies, that the bridges don't collapse, the drinking water stays safe. You can't do that without compromise, and too much transparency makes compromise impossible.
So for those who are elected officials in the audience, compromise or agreeing to even discuss the term, let alone engage in the process, can be the end of a political career. What advice do you have?
Well, I mean, that's why you have to have systems that get away from the closed party primary, so that all of the people in the community have a voice. That all of the people, you have to appeal to win in the end. You have to appeal to the broader community, because you know that there's going to be Republicans voting, Democrats voting, Libertarians, Greens, whatever, all have a choice, and you have to be responsive to the entire community. So that's the only way you can do it, is that you have to bring pressure from the community at large and not allow the small ideological subsets to control the process.
In California, the locally elected officials are nonpartisan, but California has term limits, and so yeah. It's only a few years, a matter of a few years, before those locally elected officials end up in the state house and possibly in Washington, D.C. How can you keep the nonpartisan nature of these elected officials alive during that journey?
I don't know that you can keep the nonpartisan, as long as you allow the party leadership to control what your congressional district will look like, you know, how it will be drawn, as long as you allow them to control what your committee assignments are going to be, you're not going to get past it. Angus King, I mentioned before, got elected to the U.S. Senate as a as an independent and serves as an independent, but he caucuses with the Democrats, and he'll tell you why he caucuses with them. He said, because otherwise I have to caucus with one of the parties or I won't get a committee assignment. And so you have to change it fundamentally. At that, you know, I think the most you can hope for at this point is to have, it's not nonpartisan, but bipartisan people who will elect who say, I will sit down with and talk with people on the other side to find out where the peace is, where we can come together. And you know, that's the most you're going to get.
Okay. In this very diverse United States, do you see that there are multiple United States? In other words, what is the impact of regionalism on public policy?
I think it's very real. It's I'm a living example. I was elected and served from Oklahoma, and then after I left Congress, I went to teach at Harvard. Man, Massachusetts and Oklahoma are two universes. They're not even two planets. No, I mean, there are regional differences. People in different parts of the country have different experiences. They have different agricultural products. They have, you know, some are very urban, some are less urban, some are, you know, very industrial, some are agricultural. There are real differences, and that's why you have to have the ability to compromise. If you had a system that only looks out for the industrial interests, and to heck with agriculture, so what you do is you say, well, let's draw this. The big industrial cities would say, what's the ideal price to have to pay for a loaf of bread? 3 cents. Sounds about right. You know, well, there goes the wheat production. I mean, that forces compromise. That's the whole idea, is we are a big place. It's not just 300 million people. It's very different kinds of areas with different kinds of economic interests and so forth. It's, you know, you've got areas that are very heavily Roman Catholic and others that are very heavily, you know, Protestant. There has to be a way for people in a country this big and this diverse to sit and talk to each other as one country. And you have to create the system that will allow you to do that.
Well, unfortunately, we've come to the part of the program where we have just one question left.
Oh, no.
And
is it really bad?
Here it is.
Is it scary?
No, I don't think so. Have you become disillusioned with politics? And the follow-up to that is, how can we remain optimistic about the future?
I am not disillusioned about politics because I am not disillusioned about America. And it is politics that allows us to keep this system of government that every other nation in the world would envy. But it requires participation. It requires us literally to take back the country from pure politicians and let the people again have an active voice. So I am optimistic. I see it moving in that direction. I think we're at the beginning of a revolution. We've had several of these kinds of cultural revolutions and political revolutions. I think we're at the beginning of one. We are at the beginning of the revolution of, you know, we're tired of the party system. We're going to let the people let democracy prevail, not party advantage. So, I'm upbeat about it. I mean, you know, you guys are the role models for me.
Okay. Well, I hope you all enjoyed this afternoon program hosted by the Markless Center for Applied Ethics and the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we would like to thank former U.S. Congressman Mickey Edwards, our audience here at Santa Clara University, and all of those of you who are joining us on the radio. And now this meeting is adjourned.